A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to continue our series on encoded messages in children's television, and he's zeroed in on the Teletubbies. His core argument is that the biggest mistake people make is treating them as this homogeneous blob of otherworldly cuteness, when in reality, each Teletubby encodes a distinct, strange personality that maps onto some kind of archetypal paradigm. He also wants to know what on earth that baby-faced son was supposed to represent. So the question is, do Tinky Winky, Dipsy, La La, and Po actually form a deliberate quartet of societal archetypes? And if so, what's the code?
I love this. I genuinely love this. Because the Teletubbies are one of those cultural artifacts that everyone remembers, but almost nobody reads closely. They're like the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper, so thoroughly absorbed into the texture of 90s childhood that we stopped asking what they meant. But the show's creator, Ann Wood, and the lead psychologist, Andrew Davenport, who by the way has a PhD in speech sciences and was literally studying infant-directed speech before he co-created this thing, they weren't just throwing shapes at the wall.
You're saying there's an intentional architecture here.
I'm saying the show was built by people who thought deeply about developmental psychology, and that means the character design was almost certainly systematic. Whether it's an archetypal paradigm in the Jungian sense is a separate question, but the idea that each Teletubby is a distinct psychological profile, that's not just plausible, it's basically undeniable once you start looking at the evidence.
Walk me through them one by one. Start with the purple one.
The largest Teletubby, purple, carries a red handbag. And this is where the first layer of encoding gets interesting, because Tinky Winky became the center of a genuine cultural firestorm. In 1999, the American televangelist Jerry Falwell publicly denounced Tinky Winky as a gay role model, purple being a gay pride color, the triangle antenna, the handbag. It was a big deal. Falwell issued a statement in his National Liberty Journal warning parents about the hidden sexual agenda.
The handbag is actually the key detail here, isn't it? Because if you're designing a character for toddlers, you don't accidentally give a large purple creature a red handbag. That's a choice.
And the show's creators never backed down from it. They didn't change the character. But here's what I think the deeper encoding actually is. Tinky Winky isn't a gay role model in any political sense. Tinky Winky represents the archetype of the gentle giant, the large-bodied creature who moves slowly, speaks in a deep voice, and carries a nurturing accessory. The handbag is a caregiving symbol. Tinky Winky is the maternal archetype housed in a masculine-coded body, which is subversive for a children's show, but in a way that's about expanding the emotional range available to boys, not about sexuality.
This scandal was a misreading of a misreading.
A misreading of a deliberate ambiguity that was itself the point. The show is saying, large, deep-voiced beings can be tender and carry bags. That's the whole message. And the fact that adults projected an entire culture war onto it says more about the adults than about Tinky Winky.
The Tinky Winky hermeneutic circle. All right, what about the green one?
Green carries a black and white top hat, and this is crucial. Dipsy is the most stubborn Teletubby. The name itself is a clue. Dipsy suggests contrary, Dipsy Doodle not going straight. In the show's internal logic, Dipsy frequently refuses to participate in group activities, often says no, and has a distinct contrarian streak. The top hat is the giveaway. The top hat is the accessory of the performer, the magician, the showman, but also the iconoclast. Think of the Mad Hatter, think of vaudeville.
Dipsy is the trickster.
The trickster archetype, yes. The Jungian trickster is the figure who disrupts order, who challenges the group consensus, who says no when everyone else says yes. Dipsy's antenna is a dipstick, that's literally the visual pun, which is the tool you use to check levels, to probe, to test. Dipsy tests boundaries. And the top hat is black and white, which in the Teletubbies' hyper-saturated color world is itself a statement. Everyone else is monochrome bright. Dipsy's accessory is dual-toned liminal.
Liminal top hat. That's a band name if I've ever heard one.
It absolutely is. But here's where the archetypal reading gets really specific. There's a Gungian concept called the puer aeternus, the eternal youth who refuses to grow up, who resists conformity. Dipsy isn't quite that. The Teletubbies are already eternal children, but Dipsy is the one who most actively resists the group's collective impulse. When the Teletubbies all do the same dance, Dipsy is the one who does it differently.
That maps onto something real in social groups. Every preschool cohort has the kid who won't join the circle.
And the show is encoding that as legitimate. Dipsy isn't punished for being contrary. Dipsy is part of the group. The contrariness is integrated.
Yellow, curly antenna, and I remember a giant orange ball.
La'ala is the most interesting to me because La'ala is the one critics tend to overlook. Yellow, the curly antenna, which looks like a question mark or a musical notation, and the accessory is an enormous orange ball. La'ala sings constantly. La'ala is literally the sound of singing, la-la-la. And the orange ball is a classic symbol of play, of circularity, of completeness.
If Tinky Winky is the caregiver and Dipsy is the trickster, what's La'ala?
The expressive archetype. La'ala is the one who processes experience through creative output. When something happens in Teletubbyland, La'ala sings about it. The ball is the medium of play, and play is the child's primary mode of making meaning. In archetypal terms, La'ala maps onto what Jungians would call the creator or the artist, the part of the psyche that transforms raw experience into expressive form.
The fact that La'ala is often the one who initiates group play sequences.
La'ala is the social facilitator through aesthetic means. She doesn't lead through authority, that's more Tinky Winky's domain, she leads through creative invitation. She'll bounce the ball, and the bouncing becomes the game, and everyone joins. That's the artist's role in any community, not to command, but to create the structure that others can enter.
She's the camp counselor with the guitar.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability. But yes, exactly that. And here's the thing. In most children's programming, the creative character is the protagonist. The artist is the hero. In the Teletubbies, La'ala is one of four. The creative impulse isn't elevated above the others. It's one mode among equals.
Which brings us to Poe. Red's smallest, round antenna drives a scooter.
Poe is fascinating. Poe is the smallest, speaks in a high-pitched voice that's often the most linguistically minimal. Lots of single words, lots of Poe, as self-reference. And Poe's accessory is a scooter, a mode of transport. Poe is constantly moving, zipping around, testing physical limits. And Poe's antenna is a circle, which is the shape of completeness, but also the shape of a wheel.
The kinetic archetype.
The explorer, the physical self. Poe represents embodied experience, the child who learns by doing, by touching, by moving through space. In developmental psychology, there's a whole literature on kinesthetic learning. Some children process information primarily through physical movement, and Poe is that child. When the Teletubbies encounter something new, Poe's first instinct is to approach it physically, ride toward it.
This maps onto the four temperaments if you squint, doesn't it? Tinky Winky is phlegmatic, slow, gentle, nurturing. Dipsy is choleric in the contrarian sense, or maybe melancholic, the one who steps back and says no. La'ala is sanguine, outgoing, creative, socially warm. And Poe is, the four temperaments don't quite line up.
They don't, and I think that's the wrong grid. The four temperaments, sanguine, choleric, melancholic, phlegmatic, that's a Galenic medical framework from ancient Greece. It's not what the Teletubbies are doing. I think the better lens is something closer to the Jungian four functions, thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition. Okay, this is going to get speculative, but stay with me. Tinky Winky is feeling, the nurturing relational function oriented toward care and emotional attunement. Dipsy is thinking, the contrarian, the one who steps back and evaluates, who says no when group feeling says yes. Poe is sensation, pure embodied physical experience, the kinesthetic mode. And La'ala is intuition, the creative, pattern-making function that sees possibilities and expresses them.
Cleaner than I expected. But does it hold up under scrutiny? The thinking type as the contrary one. That's a bit reductive.
It is reductive, and I'm not sure Andrew Davenport was sitting there with a copy of Psychological Types open. But here's what I think is more likely. Davenport and Ann Wood were both deeply read in developmental psychology, and what they almost certainly knew is that children's cognitive styles cluster into observable types. Some kids are more relational, some more analytical, some more physical, some more creative. You see this in any preschool classroom. The Teletubbies may not be a deliberate Jungian encoding, but they are an encoding of something real about developmental diversity.
The archetypes are descriptive, not prescriptive. They're observing that children come in these flavors, not saying you must be one of four.
And that's why the show works. Kids don't watch Teletubbies and think, I am Dipsy. They watch and recognize all four because all four modes exist in every child. The Teletubbies externalize internal diversity.
All right, let's talk about the elephant in the dome. The Sun Baby.
The Sun Baby. This is where the show tips from clever developmental encoding into something uncanny. The sun in Teletubby Land has the face of a real human baby, a 9-month-old infant named Jess Smith, by the way, who was filmed laughing and cooing. The sun rises at the beginning of each episode and sets at the end, and the baby's face is giggling throughout. It's the framing device for the entire show.
It's unsettling in a way that's hard to articulate. I remember watching this with my friend's kids years ago, and feeling like I was looking at something religious.
You're not wrong. There's a substantial body of analysis that reads the Teletubby Sun Baby as a divine figure. The baby's face in the sky, watching over everything, laughing benevolently, it's basically a deistic god. An uninvolved creator who observes but doesn't intervene. The Teletubbies never acknowledge the sun. They never look up and wave. The sun is just, omnipresent, omnibenevolent, and completely beyond interaction.
The baby is the unmoved mover.
Aristotle's prime mover, but make it giggly. And here's what I think is sophisticated about this design choice. The target audience for Teletubbies is roughly 12 to 18 months old. That's the age when children are developing what psychologists call social referencing. The ability to look at a caregiver's face to gauge how to respond to a situation. The sun baby's laughing face is a constant social reference signal saying everything is fine, this is safe, this is joyful.
It's a regulatory mechanism. The baby face regulates the watching baby's emotional state.
That's the developmental psychology reading, and I think it's correct. But the theological reading is also there, and I don't think it's accidental. Ann Wood has talked in interviews about wanting to create a world that felt timeless and mythic. A giggling baby in the sky is about as mythic as it gets.
There's something else about the sun baby that I think gets overlooked. The baby is the only real thing in Teletubby Land. Everything else, the hills, the dome, the tubby toast, the new vacuum cleaner, is artificial, constructed, costumed. The baby is actual footage of an actual human, so the one element of reality in this constructed universe is an infant consciousness that can't yet speak.
That's such a good point. The baby is the anchor of the real, and the baby can't talk, can't explain, can't narrate, can only express pure affect. Which means the governing intelligence of Teletubby Land is pre-verbal, pre-rational, purely emotional. The world is watched over by a god who feels but doesn't think.
That's either deeply comforting or existentially terrifying, and I'm not sure which.
It's both. It's the Teletubbies' version of the sublime. But let me push on something you said. The baby isn't the only real thing. The live-action segments, the windows in the Teletubbies' tummies that show real children doing real things, those are actual documentary-style footage. Those are real kids. So the structure of each episode is mythic frame with the baby sun, then the Teletubbies in their constructed world, then a window into actual human childhood, then back to the Teletubbies, then the baby sun sets.
It's a nested reality. The baby sun contains the Teletubbies, and the Teletubbies contain the human children on their tummy screens. Reality at the outer edge, reality at the inner core, and the fictional creatures in between.
Which is exactly the structure of a lot of religious cosmologies. The divine surrounds and indwells the world, with created beings in the middle. I'm not saying Teletubbies is a secret catechism, but the structural parallels are not nothing.
Let's go back to the four Teletubbies as a paradigm. One of the things Daniel's prompt is asking is whether this maps onto how we view archetypal characters in society. And I think there's something here about the show refusing to have a main character.
This is huge. There's no protagonist. In almost every children's show, there's a central character, Elmo, Bluey, Peppa Pig, and a supporting cast. Teletubbies gives you four equals. They take turns having the tummy screen moment. They share the tubby custard. Nobody gets more screen time.
That's a political statement, whether intentional or not. A group of four with no hierarchy.
It's a quadrumvirate. And quadrumvirates are rare in children's media because they're harder to write. You need four distinct personalities that balance each other without anyone dominating. The Teletubbies pull it off by making the differences clear but non-competitive. Tinky Winky doesn't boss anyone around. Dipsy's contrariness doesn't lead to exclusion. It's a vision of pluralism that's radical for toddler programming.
The four faces of Mount Teletubby. Alright, let's talk about what's missing. If this is a paradigm for viewing archetypal characters in society, what archetypes aren't here? There's no villain. There's no authority figure. There's no wise elder.
The absence of a villain is the most striking omission, and I think it's the most deliberate. Teletubby Land is a prelapsarian world. There's no conflict, no scarcity, no threat. The closest thing to an antagonist is the Nu-Nu, the vacuum cleaner that sometimes sucks up things the Teletubbies are playing with. But the Nu-Nu is more of a playful disruption than a villain. It never harms anyone.
The Nu-Nu is the superego.
The Nu-Nu is absolutely the superego. It enforces order, cleans up messes, and operates on its own logic that the Teletubbies don't control. But it's not punitive, it's just present. It's the Freudian superego as a blue vacuum cleaner with a mind of its own.
The voice trumpets. The periscope-like speakers that rise out of the ground and announce things.
Those are the voice of authority, but a disembodied, benevolent authority. The voice trumpets say things like, "Time for Tubby Toast," or "Where has the ball gone?" They're prompts, not commands. They structure the day without enforcing it. They're the schedule, not the law.
Teletubby Land has infrastructure. The dome, the Nu-Nu, the voice trumpets, the tubby custard dispenser. But no government. It's anarcho-syndicalism for toddlers.
With a giggling baby god as the head of state. It's the strangest political philosophy ever broadcast to millions of children, and nobody noticed because everyone was too busy arguing about Tinky Winky's handbag.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Is it possible we're overreading this? That four Teletubbies were chosen because four is a manageable number for a children's show, and the colors and accessories were chosen because they're visually distinct and toyetic.
The toyetic argument is real. The Teletubbies were a merchandising phenomenon. Four distinct characters in four bright colors with four distinct accessories. That's a product designer's dream. But I don't think the commercial explanation cancels the psychological one. Ann Wood was a former teacher and children's book editor. Andrew Davenport was a speech science researcher. These are people who thought deeply about what they were making. The fact that the character design also sold plushies doesn't mean it wasn't meaningful.
Commercial viability and symbolic depth aren't mutually exclusive.
They often go together, actually. The most commercially successful children's properties are usually the ones that work on multiple levels. Kids respond to the surface. Colors, sounds, shapes, parents respond to something else, and the creators get to embed the stuff they actually care about.
Let's talk about Tubby Custard and Tubby Toast. These are the only consumables in Teletubby Land. Pink custard that comes out of a machine, and toast that's...
Tubby Toast is brown toast with a pink center, dispensed from a machine that looks like a face. The Tubby Custard is bright pink and comes from a dispenser that the Teletubbies operate by going, "Eh-ho." And here's where it gets weird. The custard and the toast are the only food. There's no variety, no nutrition, no meal structure. The Teletubbies eat when prompted, share equally, and never want for anything different.
It's manna. It's literally manna. Food that appears from a machine. Always sufficient, always the same. No agriculture, no preparation, no scarcity.
The manna reading is hard to escape. And the pink color is doing something specific. Pink is not a food color in nature. Pink food is artificial, processed, candy-like. Tubby custard is the ur-candy, the platonic form of a treat, divorced from any natural origin. It's food that has no history, no source, no season. It just is.
Which fits the prelapsarian reading. In Eden, food just exists. You don't farm it, you don't kill it, you don't even cook it. The custard machine is the tree of life, but make it pink and delicious.
Nobody hoards it. There's an episode where Poe eats too much Tubby Custard and gets a tummy ache, but even that isn't framed as moral failing. It's just a physical consequence. The show doesn't moralize about consumption. It just presents a world where sharing is the default, because there's always enough.
If we synthesize all of this, the four archetypes, the baby god, the mana economy, the absence of conflict, what's the actual encoded message? What is Teletubbies saying about the world it's preparing children for?
I think the message is something like, the world is safe, you are one of several valid ways of being, difference is non-threatening, and resources are abundant. That's a profoundly optimistic cosmology. And it's one that doesn't match the actual world children grow into, which raises the question of whether the show is preparing them or sheltering them.
That's the critique, isn't it? That Teletubbies is too soft, too conflict-free, too unreal. That it doesn't equip children for a world with scarcity and disagreement.
The counter-argument, which I think Davenport would make, is that very young children, 12 to 18 months, aren't developmentally ready for conflict narratives. At that age, they're still forming their basic sense of trust in the world. Eric Erickson's first psychosocial stage is trust versus mistrust. Teletubbyland is a trust-building environment. The conflicts come later, in shows for older children.
It's not that the show denies conflict exists. It's that the show is targeted at an age where the developmental task is building a foundation of security.
And if you look at the tummy screen segments, the windows that show real children, those do include mild challenges. A child trying to build something and it falling down. A child learning to ride a bike. Small, manageable difficulties in a real-world context. The Teletubbies themselves live in the pre-challenge world, but they show you the world where challenges exist.
The Teletubbies are the audience. The children on the tummy screens are the future.
That's a beautiful way to put it. The Teletubbies watch the real children the same way the real children watch the Teletubbies. It's a reciprocal gaze. The show is modeling what it means to be an observer, to watch others learn and grow.
Which brings us back to the sun baby. The baby watches everything but can't participate. The Teletubbies watch the real children but can't enter their world. The real children watch the Teletubbies but can't enter Teletubby land. Everyone is watching someone else's reality through a screen.
This was 1997. The show premiered in March of 97 on BBC Two. This was before smartphones, before YouTube, before the screen-saturated childhood we have now. And yet the entire structure of the show is about mediated reality, watching others through screens, living in a world where a giant face in the sky is normal.
Teletubbies predicted the Zoom call.
The tummy screens are tablets. The baby sun is a face on a screen. The voice trumpets are push notifications. Teletubbyland is a smart home with a cloud-based deity and four roommates who communicate primarily through gestures and simple vocalizations. It's the most prescient piece of children's media ever produced.
All right, I want to circle back to the individual Teletubbies, because there's a dimension we haven't touched. Tinky Winky, Dipsy, Lala, Poe. What's the naming logic?
This is where Davenport's speech science background really shows. The names are phonetically designed for infants. Tinky Winky uses reduplication, repeating the same syllable pattern with a vowel change. Dipsy is a single reduplicated syllable. Lala is pure reduplication, the same syllable twice. Po is a single explosive consonant plus a vowel, the simplest possible name designed for the smallest character.
The names get simpler as the characters get smaller.
Tinky Winky, the largest, has the most phonetically complex name, four syllables, consonant clusters. Dipsy has two syllables. La-a-la has two identical syllables. Po has one. The naming maps onto the physical scale. And all four names use sounds that infants acquire early, P-B-D-T-L-W. No R sounds, no fricatives, no consonant clusters that a one-year-old couldn't produce.
That's thoughtful. The show is meeting children at their developmental level right down to the phonemes.
The names are also nonsense words with no prior meaning, which means the child encounters them without semantic baggage. Tinky Winky doesn't mean anything else. It's pure sound attached to a purple creature. The show is creating its own language. A-O is the greeting. It's the Teletubbies' hello. And again, it's phonetically simple. Two vowels separated by a glottal stop, which is one of the earliest sounds infants make. The entire linguistic world of the show is designed to be producible by a child who's just learning to talk.
The archetypal encoding isn't just in the personalities and the accessories. It's in the very sounds of their names. Each Teletubby is an archetype, you can literally say.
That's the genius of it. The show is operating on multiple levels simultaneously. Visual, auditory, kinesthetic, social, symbolic, and all of them are tuned to the same developmental frequency. It's not just that the Teletubbies represent different personality types. It's that the representation is embedded in every aspect of the design.
I want to push on one thing, though. You said earlier that the four temperaments don't map cleanly, and you proposed the Jungian functions instead. But there's another four-part framework that might fit even better. The four humors in medieval medicine. Blood, phlegm, yellow bile, black bile, which correspond to the temperaments. And humors are bodily fluids, which is relevant to a show where the characters have TV screens in their stomachs.
That's a reach, but I like it. The tummy screens are literally showing you what's inside the Teletubbies. It's a humoristic model where the interior is made visible. Tinky Winky's tummy shows nurturing scenes. Dipsy shows, I don't know, scenes of mild defiance?
Dipsy's tummy shows a child saying no to something.
But I think the humor's framework breaks down because the show isn't medicalizing personality. It's not saying these are fluids that need balancing. It's saying these are modes that coexist. The Teletubbies don't need each other to balance their humors. They just are together, and the togetherness is the point.
Let me try another framework. The four cardinal directions. The four seasons. The four elements.
The elements one is tempting. Tinky Winky is earth, large, grounded, slow. Dipsy is air, the contrarian, the one who moves differently. La as water, flowing, musical, creative. Po as fire, small, fast, energetic. But I think this is one of those cases where the mapping is so flexible that it becomes meaningless. You could map any quartet onto any other quartet if you squint hard enough.
Which is exactly the trap Daniel's prompt is warning about. The question isn't, can we find a four-part framework that fits? It's, did the creators encode a specific framework? And if so, which one?
My answer is, they encoded a framework, but it's not a pre-existing one. They created their own. The Teletubbies' personality system is sui generis. It draws on developmental psychology, on observations of real children, on the practical needs of a TV show with four characters. It's not a code you can crack with a key from some other tradition. It's a code that creates its own key.
The Teletubbies are the Rosetta Stone of their own language.
And that's why the show endures. If it were just a simple allegory, Tinky Winky equals phlegmatic, Dipsy equals choleric, it would be boring. It would be a one-to-one mapping that you figure out, and then you're done. But the Teletubbies are irreducible to any single framework, which means they keep generating new readings.
The handbag keeps giving.
The handbag is the gift that keeps on giving. And we haven't even talked about the fact that the Teletubbies' home is a dome built into a grassy hill that looks like a hobbit house designed by a Soviet architect.
The Tubbytronic Superdome. That's the official name. Which is an incredible name. It sounds like a nuclear command center.
It's one of the great names in television history. The Tubbytronic Superdome. It's simultaneously adorable and ominous. And the interior is all curved, white surfaces, no corners, no sharp edges. It's a padded cell designed by someone who read too much Le Corbusier.
The set design is doing something specific too, right? The outdoor scenes are shot in a real field in Warwickshire, with real grass and real sky, except for the baby sun, which is composited in. The indoor scenes are on a soundstage. So the show is constantly moving between the natural and the constructed.
The Teletubbies themselves are creatures in full-body costumes with limited facial mobility, which means they occupy an uncanny valley between human and animal, between expressive and inexpressive. Their faces don't move much. Their emotions are conveyed through body language, through the pitch of their vocalizations, through the way they move. It's a very physical performance style.
Which goes back to Poe as the kinesthetic archetype. The entire show is kinesthetic. The Teletubbies communicate through movement more than through words.
The word Teletubbies itself, tele, from television, tubbies, from their round bodies. They're television creatures. Their bodies are televisions. Their tummies are screens. They exist to be watched and to watch. They're the first generation of children's characters who are explicitly about mediation.
They're not just on TV. They are TV.
They are TV, and the baby sun is the off switch. When the baby sets, the show ends. When the baby rises, the show begins. The sun is the broadcast schedule.
The god of Teletubbyland is literally the programming director.
The divine scheduler. And the Teletubbies go to sleep when the sun sets, which means their entire diurnal cycle is controlled by the broadcast. They live inside the schedule. They have no existence outside of it.
This is getting dark.
It's only dark if you think about it, which toddlers don't. Toddlers experience Teletubbyland as a seamless, joyful present. The darkness is for the parents, and for the podcast hosts analyzing it 29 years later.
All right, let's bring this home. Daniel asked whether the Teletubbies' stated identities map onto an encoded paradigm for viewing archetypal characters in society. What's our answer?
Yes, with a caveat. The paradigm is real, it's deliberate, and it's elegant. Four modes of being, none dominant, all complementary. The caregiver, the contrarian, the creator, the explorer. But the paradigm isn't a key to some external system. It's a self-contained model of developmental pluralism. The Teletubbies don't teach children to categorize people into types. They teach children that the group contains difference, and difference is fine.
The baby son?
The baby son is the audience. The baby son is the child watching at home, projected into the sky, given divine status, laughing at the silliness of it all. The show's final message is, you, the pre-verbal infant, are the center of the universe. Everything exists for your delight. Now go to sleep.
Which is either the most affirming thing a children's show has ever said, or the most narcissistic.
It's both. And that's the Teletubbies in a nutshell. Affirming and unsettling, simple and complex, a giggling baby god and four creatures in a hobbit dome eating pink manna. It's the strangest masterpiece in children's television.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, missionaries in Suriname documented that the local Nduka language had the largest recorded set of kinship terms in any Creole language of the Americas, with over 50 distinct terms for different types of cousins depending on relative age, gender of the connecting parent, and whether the relation was parallel or cross.
Over 50 terms for cousins.
I'd need a chart just to attend a family reunion.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back with more encoded messages and overanalyzed children's television.
Until then, Ao.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.